Counsel ready?
Ready, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. First, I'd like to address their defendant's motion for to take judicial notice of the three documents. The first two are recorded documents recorded in the county recorder's office, but while defendant says all of the documents referenced are a matter of public record and are thus proper, it is incorrect. Exhibit 3 is actually from MERS' own website. If you look back at the document itself, you can see that it's a web page screenshot. It says copyright by MERS Core Holding, and under the HTTP, it is MERS Inc. So it is not a public document, and therefore, under Dingell versus Bioport, 270 F sub 2nd 968, 2003 case, it talks about private websites. And it says, because it could not verify the information found on these websites for accuracy or authenticity, they would not be accepted. Considering that MERS is a private organization, they keep their documentation private, there is no way to determine the validity of the statements made on its website. You're just supposed to take their word for it. So therefore, it is not appropriate for judicial notice. And
so you're saying the distinction between private websites and public websites being what?
Being that public websites, for example, if you were on the county recorder's office website, that may be appropriate.
Public, you mean like government?
Public like government, exactly. Not public like...
Because there are websites that are public in the sense that anybody on the Internet can access them.
Correct.
And then there are websites that are internal. For example, in the federal judiciary, we have an intranet, and there are certain websites we can access from our court computers, but we couldn't access. So one might draw that distinction. One could say that's a private website, whereas everything in the outer world is a public website.
Well, that would be wonderful, because WikiLeaks says all kinds of things, and therefore we could present everything on the Internet as if it was true, and the court would have to take judicial notice of it. So that's exactly why the court in Dingell said it has to be able to be verified. So, for example, if you have a county recorder's office, like the first two documents, one could, if one wanted, go down to the county recorder's office, the official building of the county. One could look up the records, pull the document, get a certified copy, and know that the actual document on the website was the actual document that was recorded. For MERS, or for any private company, they put in a list of whom they believe their members are, and then you go to verify it.
So this is only significant, I take it, if we agree with your argument that that only subsequent or successor lenders within the MERS registry can be represented by MERS. And I didn't see any language to that effect in the actual language of the deed of trust or the I'm not sure why I saw the purchase and sale agreement. So I didn't see any language to that effect. And the language in Cervantes that you quote doesn't really say that, doesn't go that far. So why should it make any difference given the plain language of the contract saying that MERS has the authority to act for the lender's successors? Why would it make any difference if the successors are part of the registry or not?
Well, what the what they're pointing out in Cervantes, I believe, is that the transfer has to be recorded in the county recorder's office, and it just describes when MERS holds the beneficial interest and when are they allowed to transfer. And
well, the language from Cervantes only says it's not recorded in the registry, but in the MERS registry, but I'm not sure how that affects MERS' authority to act for the lender's successors and assigns, which is what the language of the agreement says.
Well,
it doesn't say that authority ends if a lender is not a customer of MERS.
Well, then MERS would be the successor and would represent anybody
who was a successor lender. I mean, that's what the plain language of the deed of trust says.
Well,
MERS has nominee for lender and lender's successors and assigns.
All I can say is we disagree. We believe that if you're not a member of MERS, you have not made a contract with MERS. You are not in privity with MERS. The lender, the assignee, never signs the document. So you have a one-sided document claiming that the person who signs it represents the person who received it, but the person who receives it never signs, never agrees, is not, in fact, in contractual privity with MERS at all. And now we know from Cervantes that if they're not, then MERS is no longer going to track them, no longer has anything to do with it in MERS' own opinion. So you have to get authority from somewhere, and you can't get authority to represent and be an agent from somebody else.
So that would be an issue between MERS and the successor lender, right? But I'm not sure the borrower just agreed that MERS could act for the lender's successors and assigns. I guess I don't understand how the borrower would have be in a position to make that argument.
Well, because the borrower is the one who signed the original document, and the borrower is the one who, looking at the document, first of all, as if any borrower looked at these documents, which is extremely unlikely. It really comes down to the point as how did these people become an agent? You cannot become an agent.
Well, that language was in the deed of trust, so presumably the borrower signed that and is held to whatever was in the deed of trust. So obviously the borrower is responsible for that language and agrees that MERS can act for the lender's successors and assigns.
But does not agree and does not make them the successors and assigns. You cannot make somebody an agent of somebody else by your own agreement. So in our view, if you come in and I were to say, well, look, this person's going to represent you, you have to agree or that person does not represent you. Otherwise, as an agent, that person could make representations on your behalf. Everything they do could be put back to you and respondent superior. And so suddenly you have two parties saying, look, we agree that you're going to be the agent of a third party yet unknown.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
Question slightly off of that subject. Did your client raise this in the foreclosure proceedings as a defense?
In the foreclosure proceedings?
Yes.
No.
This is a wrongful foreclosure action, right? Where is the foreclosure?
What's
the status of the foreclosure?
No foreclosure has taken place. The foreclosure has been...
So wouldn't this be properly raised as a defense in the foreclosure action rather than as...
Well, there is no foreclosure action. It's a non-judicial foreclosure. So there is nowhere for a borrower to challenge in the non-judicial system. There is no place for them to come out and say, we object. The only thing you can do is exactly what Mr. Obano did, which is go to the courthouse and say, wait a minute, this foreclosure process, going back to the notice of default, going to a notice of trustee sale, going to any of those non-judicial, we have no way of doing that other than that. And that's certainly one of the advantages of a judicial foreclosure is that the lender is the plaintiff. The lender, therefore, has to prove their case. In a non-judicial state, pretty much anybody can record a notice of default, and anyone can record the notice of trustee sale.
So the person who holds the note would be the person to foreclose.
Exactly right.
Okay. And who holds the note here?
Exactly.
Who holds the note here?
Exactly. Nobody knows.
Nobody knows?
Absolutely. Nobody knows. By the way, the person who probably holds it. They have no
It's endorsed evidence. In blank, is it not? The note is endorsed in
yeah,
blank.
Yeah, it's endorsed in blank, so whoever
finds it. The holder
it.
Of the note has the right to foreclose.
That's right. It's exactly like a lotto.
And where does your client get standing to question how that person came into possession of the note itself then?
Who is the person that we're questioning?
Why does it matter to your client?
What's that?
Why does it matter to your client?
Well, under Ivanova, you can't just be a bounty hunter. Lenders are not just walking around looking for loans. They have to say, as Ivanova says clearly, To say that just because somebody else may be owed the money, you don't owe money to the world at large. So if I borrow money from Your Honor and you come to collect, I don't have to pay you.
You owe money to the holder of the note.
That's right.
So the identity of that person is of no consequence. I mean,
it goes directly against what Ivanova says, is that what Ivanova says is you can't just foreclose because you say you have the note.
I thought Ivanova was just about standing, about whether the borrower had standing to challenge a void transaction. That was the limit of Ivanova.
That's right.
So there's no evidence here about a void transaction, because under Turner and the California cases that Turner cited, Satterbeck and the like, Glaske has been pretty much is now a dead letter. So the to the extent the argument is about deficiencies in the transfer in the trust, there's no standing on the part of the borrower, is my understanding.
Well, first of all, Ivanova did not say whether the New York statute said void or void.
Right, but Turner, a Ninth Circuit case, said that a defect in the trust papers, so that if something was transferred in contravention of the trust document, that was merely voidable.
Here's the problem. The problem is that the New York statute says void. The problem is no court, not Satterbach, not Turner, not Rajamon, has ever said the word void is ambiguous. And Merriam-Webster gave us two words, void and voidable. What Satterbach held is the New York court doesn't speak English well, and therefore they picked the wrong word. We are going to rewrite the statute to say it's voidable, not void, because if we don't, look at all the problems we're going to have. And that is simply not a decision that the courts can make. Courts can only write statutes. Well, wait a minute. Courts can't write statutes. Courts can only interpret statutes, and they cannot interpret them to mean the opposite of what the word is, especially if that word is not ambiguous, has never been found by any court to be ambiguous.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the other side.
Good morning, Your Honor. Since the court's already familiar with our arguments, I just want to summarize a few key points and perhaps address some of the comments of my colleague. Ultimately, the issues in this case are not new. They're not novel. Over the course of the past decade in California, there's been increased scrutiny on the California's non-judicial foreclosure scheme. This case raises issues with California's non-judicial foreclosure scheme. In particular, the overarching theme of the lawsuit is whether or not my client, HSBC Bank, has standing to pursue a non-judicial foreclosure sale. Now, the appellant notably doesn't argue that he hasn't made a mortgage payment since 2009 or that he's $250,000 in arrears on the loan. He posits to the court that the underlying lawsuit is intended to ascertain who, in fact, is entitled to collect those back payments from him, not, as he puts it, to obtain a free house. The primary focus of the challenge, as was made even more clear by counsel's argument, is that HSBC Bank didn't receive a valid assignment of the deed of trust. California courts and courts within the Ninth Circuit have been consistent in finding that MERS has the authority to act as a nominee for a lender and a lender's successors and assigns.
He also says that the note wasn't appropriately transferred to HSBC in the trust. It wasn't endorsed. It was stuck in the intermediaries. We don't really have the paperwork on that in the record. What's your response to that?
Sure. That was the argument, but that's not consistent with what the actual allegations in the complaint are. Turning to the complaint, the plaintiff, and that's what's even more remarkable about this case, is the appellant in this case, in his complaint, actually acknowledges that the loan was sold first from the original lender to an entity, DB Structured Products, then DB Structured Products to Ace Securities, and then from Ace Securities to the underlying securitization trust. So that's what makes this even more confusing, is the appellant actually acknowledges that the loan was sold to HSBC Bank. So it's unclear to me.
So his argument in the brief is not supported by the complaint, is what you're saying? Because in the brief he says it never got to HSBC as trustee for the trust.
That's right. The complaint, reading from paragraph 10, and this is excerpts of the record, page 71, the appellant alleges that Mortgagit, the original lender, sold plaintiff's mortgage loan to DB Structured Products. At paragraph 14, excerpts of the record, page 73, the appellant further alleges, specifically, the first true sale occurred when DB Structured Products, Inc., securitization sponsor and seller, sold the loan to Ace Securities Corp., the securitization depositor. Thereafter, Ace Securities Corp. sold the loan to HSBC Bank USA National Association, the trustee of the trust. And even if we were to assume that there was a defect at any point in that transfer, the California Supreme Court has concluded or held that a borrower who has actually suffered a wrongful foreclosure can challenge that transfer only in the event that it's void, but not if it's voidable. And as Your Honor noted, this court has already determined in the Turner case that under New York trust law, a borrower doesn't have standing to challenge that transfer. As far as counsel's arguments with respect to the motion for judicial notice are concerned, I think at the end of the day, the allegation in the complaint is that DB Structured Products is not in the MERS registry. That record is a snapshot of the MERS registry showing that, in fact, that allegation is incorrect.
Does it matter?
I don't think it matters. I think, as I noted, in this case, the appellant has actually admitted that the loan was sold to HSBC Bank. If nothing else, MERS, as the beneficiary of record, had some obligation, at least in a ministerial capacity, to transfer, for purposes of the record, that deed of trust to HSBC Bank, who was, in fact, the owner of the loan. With that, I open it up to any potential questions that Your Honors have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You used up your time. Would you like a minute for rebuttal? Okay, thank you. Case just argued, stand submitted.